call the meeting to order. And thank all members for coming up last night. It was a great meeting. I appreciate your work on all of the legislation last night. Today we have four bills in front of us. Can we start with Representative Moe? Representative Moe, welcome to your committee event.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I would like to move that the House File 1131 be laid over for possible consideration or omnibus bill, Madam Chair.
Representative Moe moves that House File 1131 be recommended to be passed and laid over for the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have had the opportunity in this committee, and many of us are here because we have a deep-seated concern for the lack of affordable housing and for homelessness in the state of Minnesota. In particular, a lot of us live in greater Minnesota, and as we heard in committee yesterday, a quarter of the homeless people in the state of Minnesota are in greater Minnesota. And not here in the metro area. We also oftentimes lack the resources to coordinate the grants and other financial resources which are available for combating homelessness in greater Minnesota. And the bill before you supports continuum of care coordinators throughout greater Minnesota, which would allow us, in particular in our area, and here an example in southeastern Minnesota here, would allow us to connect the dots. How do we, in greater Minnesota, make use of the resources that are available to us to actually combat the problem? And I just want to give one example. I mean, this in Bemidji, where I live, this is such a challenging issue. We have a church in the city of Bemidji, downtown, who, in violation of city ordinance, as the church itself is open as a homeless shelter, and the city council recognizes the immensity of the problem, and they let it go. They don't do anything about it. The police provide protection for the site, and it's a testament to the courage in our community, one, but two, the dramatic need that we have. And this would provide us with the additional assistance we need to coordinate our community efforts better, and ideally giving a more stable, relatively permanent place ultimately to those people who are now sleeping in a church basement, literally. With that, I'll turn it over to Michael Dahl, Executive Director of Minnesota College for the Homeless. You all come to know him very well.
Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Dahl.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dahl. I'm the Executive Director with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. I certainly don't want to outstay my welcome with this committee, and I realize that I've had a chance to talk with you plenty of times, and plenty of times about legislation that is extremely important about increasing services to people who are homeless or about to become homeless, and how can we do everything possible to help them. We talked a few weeks ago about the need for additional shelter and transitional housing. Yesterday we talked about family homeless prevention. We also talked about the need for more affordable housing. In greater Minnesota, there are some barriers to cobbling together those resources that we don't have here in the cities. And this bill is an attempt to make it so that rural Minnesota can compete and talk about what it does well and use that to get adequate resources to serve the need. Now, I told you all yesterday that today Wilder Research Center is going to be releasing its updated homelessness numbers. And the Star Tribune trumped us on this. I think they actually did a story in advance on the numbers. I don't think they quoted this the statistic I want to share with you, so I won't be too precise here, but I just want to let you know that the percentage of people who are from greater Minnesota and homeless has increased. It's no longer just above a quarter. We're approaching, approaching a third. We need to respond. And this is not the glitzy piece of legislation that increases services, but it increases our ability to provide those services. And so let me just give you a context for what this is. The federal government, HUD, has created this term called continuum of care. We probably use it for a lot of different things, but in the homelessness world, it's when we bring together service providers, people experiencing homelessness, business leaders, faith communities, and we get together on a regular basis and we say, how can we cobble together the resources that you provide from the state, are available from the local, how can we apply for funds from the federal government, and then also use private resources that are coming in to make this all make sense for our community. And in the metro area, the counties contribute quite heavily to this process. But for Mary, who sees a 20-county area and the counties are strapped for resources like you wouldn't believe, the counties aren't contributing as much, and it's left up to the service providers to put in the resources, to invest the resources, to figure out how to make this all make sense. And the work is basically not paid very well. And so in addition to operating a number of programs in Southeast Minnesota, Mary has to pull together federal applications to get money from the federal government for housing and homelessness. We need to do planning for the governor's plan and long-term homelessness. We need to figure out how to do homelessness prevention in our communities. We need to figure out how to provide training to service providers. We need to do everything. And in rural Minnesota, when that means you got to travel 3 hours to your next to the meeting where this happens, as do all of the other service providers from the area, and then you got to write the application, which brings together this community sense of where to go next, it's just impossible. And so I ask that you please do this small thing, which is make an appropriation, which the bill says $490,000 for the biennium, to allow 6 planners in rural Minnesota to do their job and to do it well, so that they have a fair shake compared to the cities to do homelessness planning. Now, I want to share some good news with you. Just a couple of days ago, the Greater Minnesota COCs have not had adequate funding for a long time, and they said, we can't keep praying the state's going to do the job, and so they started to apply to some private foundations. And a couple of days ago, they found out that they got a $200,000 grant. The $490,000 here is not the full bill. We think we need about $600,000. So the $200,000 brings us a little bit of the way, but we still need this money. We still need this money. But the private foundations have said, we believe in this work. We think we need to be a bridge until the state does its job. And that's what that money is about, and Mary can talk a bit about that. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to take questions after the testimony is over.
Welcome to the committee. You introduce yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you. My name is Mary Euland Evans, and I live in Viola Township, which is east of Rochester, and I work in the 20 counties of southeast and south central Minnesota. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to ask for your support for this very important bill. Michael did kind of go over some of the comments that I had planned on making, so I don't want to repeat what he said, but I do want to tell you why the continuum of care is important in Greater Minnesota. Not only is it the vehicle through which we access federal homeless assistance dollars for those 20 counties, but it's become so much more than that. The benefit of the continuum is improving the homeless response in those 20 counties. I've been working with the continuum for a dozen years now, and I have seen the response, the system in southeast and south central Minnesota improve immensely in those years. When I first started working with it, we had homeless programs, housing and service providers in communities. They didn't know what each other was doing. We had gaps in service all over the place. Since then, we have really streamlined the response to homelessness in Greater Minnesota. Referrals are immediate and effective. Homeless people are not having the runaround that they experienced and are still experiencing in some cases, because we work with like common intakes. We have just an awful lot of things in common to provide services. We share best practices with one another. We build capacity of program and housing providers that don't have that capacity. We do a lot of training. Plus, we also work with a lot of the other initiatives around the state and regionally, locally, on homelessness. So there's an awful lot of things we have to do for the little bit of money that we do receive through the state capacity building grant from the housing, from Minnesota Housing. And we also get some funding from the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. Neither one of those is secure. Every year we have to wait to find out what's going to be available. I just want to mention that we do have 191 organizations that are either directly involved with our continuum or that are peripherally involved. We only have about 15 grantees. So the continuum is worth it to 191 organizations, agencies, and individuals to continue to do what we do, even though they don't directly receive funding from HUD. You do have a handout that I passed around. This shows what we have spent at Three Rivers, since Three Rivers Community Action has coordinated this since the beginning. And in the column of the planning dollars, that's what we had available to do the planning, to develop our very competitive, very successful application to HUD. Those dollars include, if up until 2005, those dollars included the money we got from the state, a little bit from OEO, from the Housing Finance Agency. There was some other little bit of foundation funding in there. But most of those dollars up until then were subsidies that Three Rivers actually paid to continue this planning. 2 years ago, when it was so obvious that the continuums were in trouble, that we didn't have the resources we needed to do an excellent job, to be competitive, our continuum voted unanimously to institute application fees to cover the cost. So you'll see that in 2006, we spent $5,500. That came from grantees, applicants to HUD. And then last year, it was up to $39,000. Again, it was a unanimous decision. The value was there for those folks. But it's not acceptable, and it's certainly not sustainable. We really do need the resources. We don't have them from Community Development Block Grant, which is a major source for those entitlement counties. We have a lot of work to do to do this application. It's the process. It's a lot of hoops to jump through. But in the last few years, we've been getting also some mandates from the state to use this network to implement the HMIS, the Homeless Management Information System, and more recently to develop regional plans to end long-term homelessness in conjunction with the state plan. We have done that in our region. We have a phase one completed, talking about the permanent housing we need for long-term homeless. We are kind of stalled right now for lack of resources to develop phase two, which is about other homelessness, which is about services, which is about youth, domestic violence, all those different things. And we really can't move forward unless we have some resources to commit to this. We're implementing the plan. We're developing a lot of housing in the region, a lot of supportive housing in the region, but we don't really have a way of tracking that implementation and continuing to keep it going forward. I guess that's basically what I wanted to say, so thank you very much.
Thank you. We have just a few minutes for questions. Any questions from committee members? No? Okay.
It might be really easy.
Yes, and you did a very thorough presentation, and that's excellent.
If I can just make one, and Mary said it, I just want to point out, we have shelters applying to the continuum of care to apply to the federal government for money that they should be getting anyway, and they're competitive on a national basis. They're funding the system right now, and we want to make sure that they don't have to do that anymore.
Thank you. Okay, the motion is before us to lay over House File 1131 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and that's what we'll do. We'll be laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
I thank you for coming.
I appreciate the opportunity to let us help ourselves.
That's right. That's a good way to describe it, everything else. Okay, the next bill is Representative Walker. And I just want to mention to members, we have three more bills, and we have session at 11:30, so we're going to be done here at 25 after. So let's try to give our authors the courtesy that they need and opportunity to present it, and then make our questions succinct and keep on moving. Welcome to the committee, Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Mayor.
We have before us House File 1723. I'm wondering if one of the members would like to move that.
I will. I'm sorry. That's all. Representative Madar.
Yes, I'll move that bill. Thank you.
Will House File 1723 be recommended to pass, and I believe laid over for possible inclusion in this omnibus bill.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me first say, Representative Shumper, I'm glad that you're in this committee, too. So you know my pain, Representative Huntley. You too know my pain. We got done at about 12:20 this morning.
I really appreciate your being
so
here.
So no energy this morning, committee members. I'm thankful, Representative Clark, that you've had the opportunity to hear House File 1723. Members, one of the things that you know, unfortunately, although HIV has been really in our awareness as a country, as a global entity, for more than 25 years now, we have not fixed the problem. It is still a dilemma. There are still certain communities where the disparity is increasing at a higher rate compared to the population, especially here in Minnesota. While I would love to ask for tons of funding for all communities, especially communities of color, looking at a community that has an extremely small population here in Minnesota, less than 1%, wanting to figure out what we can do, and decided to work with Minnesota AIDS Project on creating a bill that would target specifically Native African individuals, individuals that originally were born in the continent of Africa. This population isn't one singular group of individuals. They have very different cultures, different traditions, different ways of communicating, and wanting to make sure that the individuals that know their particular communities and their concerns that are able to address and get to them and connect to them and address some of the stigma that might be associated, especially around this particular issue, have the resources to do that. And so I will actually stop here, Madam Chair. I do have a testifier, if that's all right with you.
Thank you. We'd love to hear from Ms. Odero. Welcome to the committee. If you'll introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee for affording me this opportunity to share with you. I've worked on HIV/AIDS field for more than 5 years in Minnesota. I've worked in clinics and I've worked out in the communities trying to do preventive education. And as Representative Walker has stated, we are just, the African immigrants in Minnesota is just 1% of the population. And in 2005, they represented 15% of new HIV cases, and most of these 15% are women. I guess it's the way we show up at the doctors. Women, we have more issues than men, I suppose, and also our health-seeking behavior is so different from the American citizens here. We only show up at the doctor when we really need to and when we've tried all the over-the-counter drugs and have failed. And most of these women show up at the prenatal clinic or for either gynecological reasons, and they then they're tested and they're found out to be HIV positive. And we are almost seeing a reflection of what is happening in sub-Saharan Africa replicating itself in Minnesota. And some of the causes of this are due to lack of basic knowledge and about HIV transmission and the risk reduction, and also the widespread fear or denial and related to very existence of HIV due to stigma, social status, and social status here I mean that an equal balance between the gender, men and women in the community, and also reluctance to discuss sexual matters, as it is sex education is something that is not a practice of most of the African communities. And I believe there's a lot that can be done if we target specifically those barriers that we have in this community. As Representative Walker said, it's a very diverse community. Even taking just one country in itself, there's about over 15 different ethnic representations in those in just one country. And we need to target our preventive, HIV preventive education, need to target the knowledge that is there in those communities, the beliefs that is there, the attitudes and the practices, and also targeting the resources that are in there. In that way, we are able to address fears, misconceptions, and misperceptions that exist as related to HIV and AIDS pandemic. And also, by doing so, we're also going to increase efforts involving African-born communities to create models of HIV prevention and care that address the behavior that can help us stop HIV. We need to draw up from these communities. Who can we use to help us in doing our preventive efforts? And in doing so, we are also going to try and empower the African women's ability to negotiate the success. Due to that unequal balance in the community regarding social status, the women do not have the capacity to negotiate for self-assess. And I think that manifests in the increase in the number of women that are diagnosed with HIV/AIDS. And I believe if we do an effective preventive education, we are going to save a lot of dollars in terms of providing care to in the future, providing care to people who've been diagnosed with HIV/AIDS. That means the numbers are going to go down. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Adara. Any other discussion or any other questions from community? I'm not kidding, Ms. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. President Walker, how many people have been diagnosed, or what is the population of the HIV community as far as people that have been diagnosed with the HIV virus? Any ideas?
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. You would ask me a difficult question considering you were in that committee room with me last night. but we do have department here, and so hopefully the department could use their brain better than I can use mine right now.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Walker, I was awake.
Yes, he counted me out. I was there. Sat in my chair. I was out.
Do we have someone from the department who can respond? Welcome to the committee, and if you just introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peter Carr, and I'm the manager of the STD and HIV section at the Minnesota Department of Health.
And I'm Craig Aikum, the Assistant Director of Infectious Disease Epidemiology. Good morning again.
Thanks. Could you please repeat the question?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, I'm just wondering how many people have been it's been found to know and have there's a population out there that have been, I guess, recognized as having the HIV population, AIDS virus, and I'm just wondering how many have been documented in your statistics.
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative, we maintain statistics on people that are diagnosed and living with HIV. At the end of 2005, there were about 5,200 people living with HIV in Minnesota that we were aware of. Of those, approximately 680 were African immigrants.
And Madam Chair,
Anderson?
Have there been success stories as to our helping in their finding solutions to the situation?
Yeah, I think we are making a milestone in cutting down the pandemic. The unfortunate thing is that the people that we are working with on positive prevention are those that have been diagnosed. The ones in the community we've not been able to reach, or those who do not know their status. As it is, people have a stigma against HIV and they will not go into tests. So we're only working with the positive people for positive prevention, and we're hoping that is going to stop the HIV spread only within the people who are HIV positive.
Madam Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, the other thing to note, I've had the opportunity over the last couple of years to go to several events that have specifically targeted the African-born population and doing a variety of community events, whether it is having some specific data there, having the Department of Health there, other resources there, doing, I think one of them was like a fashion show, doing a wide variety of things that will bring the population out and then be able to give them the information and resources that can help them.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Anderson,
is the governor, has he got a recommendation here for, or is there things coming from the department dealing with this situation?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the department is obviously aware of the importance of dealing with this particular population here in Minnesota. We currently do fund three organizations that specifically target African-born Minnesotans doing HIV prevention. The governor, however, did not include any additional funding in his budget for this activity.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just close by saying, if there's no other questions, that thank you again for the opportunity to bring this bill before you. And I know you're going to have some tough decisions moving forward while you decide your priority for funding. But keep in mind, one of the things that we do know that works and saves us long-term funding, especially on a state level, is prevention. It's the last thing that we think about. It's the last thing that usually comes to us to decide as a priority. This particular population is costing us money. Once individuals do get diagnosed with HIV, once they do go into being in full-blown AIDS, it's not just costing that individual. It's costing us in around a complete circle. It's costing our economy. It's costing our government. It's costing our hospitals. It's costing our children. It's costing our communities. It's something that could be prevented. We know how to prevent it. We just need to decide how to prioritize the funding to make sure that everyone's aware. Thank you again for your consideration.
Walker. And Medora renews the motion that House File 1723 be recommended pass and be laid over in the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. Next, bill is Representative Shepherd. Committee members, I'm very impressed. We might be able to finish on time here and get to the floor. Don't be so soon. Okay.
A vain hope, Madam Chair.
How can we be positive, guys?
Okay. Representative Shepherd, welcome back to your committee, and I know you have some guests from out of town, so thank you very much for bringing this bill. You want to move House File?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 726 for possible inclusion, laying it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Correct. Please introduce your bill and your guest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, just recall, I guess quite some time ago, we had testimony from the Community Action Partnerships in Minnesota here, which is 39 community action agencies and the tribal governments do a lot of good work locally with low-income people on housing and weatherization, meals on wheels, senior dining, a whole array of social services programs that are really important in rural areas. And our bill today, we're asking for $20 million. We certainly settled for $19,500,000 for inclusion in the your considerations for the omnibus bill. I have with me today three great witnesses that came, and so I think we'll just start with them, even though I'm really refreshed from our multi-hour health and human service meeting last night. So, Arnie, why don't you go ahead?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Arnie Anderson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. It's a pleasure to be back before you again today. We very much appreciate your time, and it's nice to be here when everybody's nice and tired and relaxed. I have three very quick points to make, and then I'm going to turn the testimony over to Patrick McFarland and Commissioner Margaret Langfeld from Anoka County. As Representative Shumper noted, we've appeared before you previously. I'd just like to refresh you that you've received copies of the annual Community Action Report, and at our last hearing we talked about the depth and breadth of community action programming. The one fact that I wanted to emphasize today was at the local level, people have a strong commitment to community action. Nearly 40,000 volunteers donated their time last year to the tune of nearly 2 million hours of volunteer time. when you're investing in community action, you're investing in a great deal of community activity. The second point that I'd like to try to make today is that community action is not only about service delivery, but community action is also very much about community building and advocacy. And you just heard a bill on the Greater Minnesota Continuum of Care, and you got a price tag for what it takes to communicate, coordinate, and collaborate on a meaningful scale on a statewide basis. Community action does this day in and day out, and this funding is crucial to allow community action to participate in that type of an activity. The total number of organizations with whom community action agencies work to promote family and community outcomes is nearly 3,000 on a statewide basis. Community action participates in 1,200 formal collaboratives around the state. And for those of you who have had a personal opportunity to work with collaboratives, you understand what the amount of time and effort that goes into that. And in many cases, community action is leading those collaboratives. I guess the point that I'd like to summarize or conclude with is that when collaboration, community building is successful, it very rarely makes a headline. It's only when those things fail that these things show up in the headlines. So with those two quick points, I'd like to turn the testimony over to Patrick McFarland and Commissioner Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Patrick McFarland. I'm with the Oak County Community Action Program in Blaine, Minnesota. I've been with the agency since 1973, been an executive director since 1978, and it's a pleasure to see an old friend holding the gavel here.
Pleasure.
I'm here to speak.
Been around a while.
I don't mean old in that sense.
Okay. Everyone in my grade.
Sorry. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 726, which restores the governor's 54% on allotment to the community action agencies during the state budget crisis. Well, I want to give the bulk of my time to Commissioner Langfeld, since she's a much better speaker than I am. I'd like to make a couple quick points based on the discussions we've been having with you all. State and federal law outlines how CAAs are organized, their functions, and their powers. Community Action Grants Program is not an open checkbook. The laws require specific uses of these funds and a process to access these funds. Agencies are required to assess the needs and develop a plan to meet these needs. State law specifically states that these funds must be coordinated with all other public and private programs serving low-income people and the low-income community, and everything we do must have a measurable impact. There's also the concept of leveraging that's come up, and just by way of that we use the word leveraging. Last year, in 2006, ACAP and its affiliated organizations and partnerships, housing partnerships that we run, had total revenues of $22,171,415. We receive a community action grant of $124,000. So by our way of thinking that we've produced, for your $1 investment, we produce $179 of services in our service area, which we think is a pretty good return on your investment. Anoka County had, in addition, 2,383 volunteers, and they served a total of 42,000 hours, or 20 full-time equivalents. Now, I want to introduce Margaret Langfeld, and if I went through all of her accolades and achievements and resume, we would be here for our whole time, and the chair would kick us out of this room. So with that, I'd say that the last time that Margaret testified on behalf of Community Action, she was president, or previous past president, of the Association of Minnesota Counties. So with that, Margaret Langfeld, thank you.
Thank you, Pat.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. I'm Margaret Langfeld. I'm a citizen. I live in Blaine. For those of you new to government, I've served in elected office for 30 years and retired the first of the year, so I don't know how long I get to carry the title of commissioner, but I'm not. I'm a citizen. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning in support of House File 726. I have been a strong supporter of Community Action Agency for over 30 years. From
as early as 1977 when Elk County Community Action Agency and I worked together to establish the one and only battered women's shelter for services for women and their children in Anoka County that still operates today very successfully. To as recent as this year when Community Action Agency took over the sponsorship of Anoka County's Birth to Three Collaborative Head Start with the funding cuts to collaborative services, the county simply was not able to do it. So Community Action Agency graciously agreed to coordinate those services, very important. We've worked with them on literally hundreds of projects and programs to help the self-sufficiency of low-income residents and families in Anoka County to make their lives better and to make our communities better. There are so many of them, but I want to tell you a few. You know Healthy Head Start very well. We've got a waiting list of 1,000 kids. We aren't able to serve more than about 20% of the kids that would be eligible to be served. That's Washington and Anoka County. I wish we could get all those kids in there for service so that they'd be prepared to start school and to learn. Anoka County Community Action Agency is the housing arm in Anoka County. Maybe Anoka County is different, but I'm not so sure we're that much different than many counties in Minnesota, where the growth in county government occurred many years ago when the federal government was handing out money left and right. While our growth in population started and the federal government was constantly pulling back on the amount of money they were going to give, we had no money to do anything. It was only by working with Community Action Agency that we were able to do anything in the area of housing. And they have been able to provide numerous housing programs for us to help low-income people with, to prevent homelessness, to help with those that are homeless, working with our corrections department so that prisoners are building some houses for low-income people. One time there were four houses that the highway department was going to tear down because they were in the way. They wanted to widen the road. And I stopped them and said, you know, couldn't we use those little houses for some people that needed housing? Well, of course, it was Community Action Agency that came to the plate and helped us put together a way to save those four little houses that then were used for women coming out of the shelter and for women with mental illness. Very important in our community. Time after time, and we have continued a program with the highway department all these years so that when they're looking at a house that is in the way, Community Action Agency many times moves that house, finds a lot, which has become more and more difficult as the price of land has increased, but to provide housing and is just about as cheap as you could possibly do it, they do it. One of my favorite programs is the senior outreach program. They have a few workers that search out those seniors in our community that are so isolated, that are would be mentally ill, no doubt, if they were left alone. Some of them are on the verge of, but helps them, you know, get connected in the community and just reaches out to them to help them. One of the other great things that we've done together is some years ago we built a human service center in Blaine. Kind of an arm of county government, but there are 26 agencies in that building, maybe more today. That's the number I remember. Our workforce center is there, and the state unemployment office is there, and Community Action is there. A whole bunch of small nonprofits that provide counseling and all those kinds of things, food shelf, all the things, so that when a person is in need in Elk County, there's one place to come. We were the first one-stop workforce center in the nation. And it has worked so extremely well. And Community Action Agency was willing to say, we'll try to help put this together. We'll manage the building so that we're doing the leasing and all those kinds of things. And it's just been an enormous success. So they have the ability to think outside the box, to do things differently than have ever been done before. And that's what Community Action can do. They are so flexible. They're fluid. You know, when funding cuts are coming down, the county always turns to Community Action. I'm sure they shiver in their boots when they see the county folks coming, but we've absolutely depended on them so much. It's been absolutely wonderful.
And when the governor unallotted the funding by 53%, it wasn't just a problem for Community Action, it was a problem for the entire system. And to get those monies back would help greatly. One of the other agencies that had to take a big cut, hit with that cut was something we call Free to Be. It's an agency that, little nonprofit that developed, their sole purpose is to help people with transportation needs. You know, in suburbia, we have very little bus service, and people want to get to work. They help people get cars. They give donated cars, they fix them up, and they give them to people that need them to be able to get to work. All of the programs they do were affected by that cut. They have rescued the county so many times. And I want you to know, you know, we know we've got serious poverty and housing problems in the inner city, but it's alive and well in suburbia as well. There are a lot of people living in poverty. You know how close families live on the edge. You know, it just takes one illness or one major event in their lives, and they're in poverty. And Community Action Agency is a place they can go where they can come and get some help with dignity and get back to be productive citizens. So I urge you to support the bill and to get the funding back for Community Action Agency. Thank you so much.
And Madam Chair and members, if I could draw your attention to the yellow handout, this summarizes the cuts in 2003 to 2004 from $8.5 million to $4 million.
And Madam Chair, if I can just, I was going to emphasize the same thing again, that, when 2003 occurred, the caps were getting about $16 million in the biennium, and they got cut back to a little over $8 million. And so most of what we're seeking here is, in fact, all of what we're seeking is a restoration of the cuts plus something to make up for inflation for the last several years. So I do want to emphasize also, if you looked over the authorship of this bill, there's a strange name, some Schumper guy who's the chief author there, but I'm very happy to have a very bipartisan bill here that's supported, including Representative Eastland, who's on this committee. And this program really has broad support in rural areas. I can tell you that from our own SEMCAC cap in southeastern Minnesota, the Southeastern Minnesota Citizens Action Council. One of their big emphases is food shelves in our rural county, and food shelf use is just skyrocketing in rural counties today. And so it's very important that we have the SEMCAC infrastructure out there in our area to help with that, as well as family planning. I know we've talked a lot on this committee about family planning and the importance of that, and SEMCAC is probably one of the few, very few agencies in our area that does comprehensive family planning. So, in our area, SEMCAC just celebrated its 40th anniversary this last year. They started in the mid-60s, and it was really quite a milestone. They're really strongly supported. So again, we all know the budget constraints we're under, but the CAP programs have really been outstanding. I really appreciate the bipartisan support for this. So, thank you, Madam.
Representative Schumper, just one question. And you're right, the community action agencies have such a fabulous reputation. I think in a number of counties, they also deal with the energy assistance, low-income, a lot of heat money. And I'm just wondering, I didn't hear that mentioned, and I'm thinking with the past winter, I'm wondering what the demand has been on the community action agency administering that.
Madam Chair, with that.
What kind of waiting lists we're talking about? Or
Most of the CAP agencies do run the energy assistance program. And my understanding is that we will be out of federal funding about April 5th or so, right in that area. Cold weather rule comes off April 15th, so at that time we would expect to be a huge demand, but we won't have any resources to serve those folks, so it's going to be a pretty tough situation out there. We were in Washington last week, a number of us lobbying on behalf of the Energy Assistance Program. The president does have a contingency that he can release. It was cold in Washington last week, so we're hoping that that will have the attention of the president and he will release, although he was in Mexico, but we're hoping that he will release those funds and that will help a little bit, but we will be running out of money this year for sure. And you may be hearing more about this in local media, I would think, coming up here. But.
Well, I'd just like to extend an invitation to you to come back to this committee when and if that happens. I think
we will be here.
Okay. Is that Graham?
I just wanted to say for the record, Madam Chair, thank you very much to the testifiers on behalf of my constituents in Blaine and Anoka County. I thank you for all of your work. And I know it's not easy meeting the needs of a growing population who many people in there don't perceive the suburbs to have these type of issues, and you quietly, you know, and effectively do your job, and there are a lot of people who benefit who aren't probably able to email us en masse or be here today to support you, but they're out there, and I too want to just publicly thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, Representative Shumper renews his motion that House File 726 be recommended to pass and delayed over in this committee for possible inclusion in the ambulance bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Our last bill, Representative Medora.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Morgan.
Yes, if I may, I would like to move the minutes of the evening meeting from Tuesday, March 13th.
Thank you, Representative Moore. It's apparently as corrected. It brought to my attention that Representative Lane is the one who renewed the motion on House File 595, and we will correct that.
Yes, as corrected. Thank
as
you,
corrected.
Madam Chair.
Okay, the minutes are before us. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor of the motion to approve the minutes indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevailed, and the minutes are approved. Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For those of you, I am here today, in case you're wondering. A little quiet this morning. I'm taking into account everybody's late evening last night. So today, Madam Chair, I'd like to move that my bill 1684 it will stay here for inclusion into the omnibus. Is that correct?
I believe that's right.
Yes. That's what I'd like to move then.
Yeah. So was it? We did move that House File 1684 be laid over, we recommend it pass laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What this bill does is it modifies the preferences in housing applications for people, for disabled veterans and people with disabilities. If all options are equal, at this point we need to be addressing the significant shortage of housing for our disabled population, both our disabled veterans, of course, and people with disabilities. Oftentimes when an apartment is available and it's a single floor with wide enough doorways, perhaps a roll-in shower, and some other amenities that make things easier for people with disabilities, giving that apartment to an able-bodied person is actually a disservice, because the cost to modify an existing dwelling or to make changes or to ask the disabled person to make those changes are significant budget issues. So in order to provide for more independence, we need to provide for more housing options, and situations where they present themselves, we would like to have courtesy and preference given to first disabled veterans coming back and then persons with disabilities. So with that, I'm willing to take any questions.
Representative Medora, I might have missed it, but this applies to what type of housing again? Could you just remind us?
This is housing that is HUD housing.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that housing has already been modified, or?
No, we're making changes right now, and we're also changing language. We used to have aid to dependent children. That's no longer called that, so we're the other line that you see, the strike-through, is also changing language here to address the public subsidy money under Chapter 25-6J.
Okay.
So it just changes the title of, so those are for families that receive assistance.
Okay, great. Representative Carlin.
Yes, Madam Chair, and Representative Medora. I am a little confused. When you're talking about persons with disabilities, are you talking about veterans or family members that are disabled?
I'm talking
anybody?
About both populations.
Okay.
Both populations. So we have first disabled veterans, and then we also have persons with disabilities. So there are actually two populations there.
Okay, I'm just looking at, and being a freshman here, I've just seen that this whole section seems to be about veterans, but we're adding anybody else who's disabled to this bill then.
That's correct.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe staff can help us. Our Representative Medora, you said 256J, or is it 256J?
Oh, I'm sorry, 256J.
Okay. I'm just wondering if the staff could give us kind of a synopsis of what 256J actually says.
Madam Chair, members, I believe 256J is the temporary assistance to families with needy children, which replaced the old aid to families with dependent children. The AFDC is an antiquated term from before they revised the statute and changed the cash assistance from.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Anderson,
do you know what the threshold is for that, for meeting that criteria?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, no, I'm sorry. I'm not really familiar with the specifics of the program.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this bill, Representative, I'm going to be speaking a little outside my pay grade, but it seems to me that historically all the veterans' kinds of issues that come before the committees has gone through, there's a big panel of all the veterans organizations that meet and kind of weigh in on these. And because the Representative Severson isn't here, who typically would know that process, my question is, has that happened? Because as I read your bill, what used to say preference was given to families of service personnel who died in service and with dependent children, it now says disabled veterans and persons with disabilities. So it's also creating a competition and a question of availability of units. And does this exclude some of those vets? And does that group weigh in on this? All that package of questions are all kind of on the same center.
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, no, it doesn't. As you know, veterans are on tiered benefit plans, and oftentimes disabled veterans, the highest tier are given preferential housing in veterans. There's the new housing development over up by the U of M. They would be given preference, but once they I wish Representative Severson was here. There's a tier level where they are not eligible for housing, and this would allow them to do to be able to qualify for housing as a disabled veteran and get some preferential treatment for placement.
Madam Chair,
Representative Peterson.
Then shouldn't on line 1.8. where it's underscored, shouldn't that really be, say, preference should be given to disabled veterans with disabilities? Because when you say veterans, comma, persons with, I read that as saying anybody with a disability now gets treated the same as veterans.
It may be. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It may be if we have the first preference, though, would be for the disabled veteran. If a disabled veteran is not present to take the property and there's a person with a disability, that person would be given preference over the next population.
And there's Madam Chair, there's enough available housing stock to allow that to happen? Probably not.
Representative Major? Madam Chair, unfortunately, Representative Peterson, no, there is not. And that's why we want to be able, most of this housing would be perhaps available near hospitals, be near transit, would be able to assist the veteran to be able to get services, and that's really what the goal of this was. Rental housing in suburbia, that's a little more difficult to come by, but here units that might be available near the veterans' homes, near medical facilities, that's the target market that we were trying to get to.
I think so. I was done before I started.
That's a good question. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just the housing stock, is this bill applying to housing that is currently
on the market that meets the criteria for all the disability codes and everything? Or is this just applied to any housing stock or any apartment or any rental unit? And the road I'm going down is what burden does that place on a landlord who maybe owns some older buildings that maybe don't meet all the handicap accessibility issues that are in current law for new construction?
Ms. Amador?
Madam Chair, Representative Eastman, these are units that are operated by the Redevelopment Authority, Housing Redevelopment Authority. Any kind of upgrade to those apartment buildings and things are up to code that would accommodate people with disabilities for the most part. What this allows for is that for where all things are equal and you have two clients and the apartment is handicap accessible. That the person with a disability, that the veteran or the person with a disability, given some preference in renting. It doesn't take away from, if the apartment is not handicap accessible, this wouldn't apply because then it would be modifications.
Representative Issa?
And another question is, how do we, is there an official way to determine if someone is disabled? I guess how do we determine that someone has a disability that would put them in this classification? Is there some official way to define that? I guess I don't know.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Representative, there is actually. Well, we have a couple of disabled people here. I think visually you can see that. But then on top of it, we do have a criteria diagnostic manual. It's called the DSM, and those of you that may be familiar with that, those are codes that are given to determine a person's disability. And those, you'd be able to qualify under that because usually you're receiving some sort of disability, either SSDI or some sort of supplemental program for your disability. And again, in order for them to apply through the Housing and Redevelopment Authority, that criteria would, I believe, would already be determined.
Okay. I have a question. Just sparked by these questions. I think in answer to one of the questions you mentioned that it's all things being equal.
Yes.
In other words, the housing unit itself is already accommodating. Or I guess that the question I have would be the size. So, for example, let's say you have a single veteran. I'm wondering how that works with in comparison to the families that are listed below. Does the language here accommodate that kind of preference or that
what's
appropriate?
Yes, Madam Chair, what that does is, again, you also are looking at an income issue with that. A single veteran or a single person with a disability is going to have a limited amount of money to spend on their rent, so they're not going to be looking for a $1,500 or $1,600 a month apartment that would perhaps better suit a family. Basically, we're looking for single person apartments or things of that nature. So all things being equal, meaning truly the client is able. Now, if we are, I'm not, in my many weeks and many years of working with the disabled population, Madam Chair, I'm not familiar with any of them wanting to spend more on rent than they've been given vouchers and assistance for. So I think that the price of the unit is what clarifies the all things being equal qualifier on that.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any further questions or discussion?
No, Madam Chair. I was not aware, but I do have a couple of people here. Do we have a minute to give them?
We do. That was just fine. Okay. Meanwhile, Representative Stevenson is getting caught up on what we've been talking about, and
right.
We can hear from your witnesses. That would be great.
Madam Chair. While they're getting ready, it was interesting last night we heard testimony, like somebody said that vets want to live with vets, and I'm thinking the reverse may not be true. We'll see. I'm trying to make light.
Oh, got it.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the Housing Policy and Finance and Public Health Finance Division, I'm Margo Indicross. I'm an accessibility specialist with the Minnesota State Council on Disability, and I'm here today to express our strong support for House File 1684. This bill includes disabled veterans and people with disabilities in the preference language for housing provided by public housing authorities. Currently, preference language goes to family of veterans who have died in service and families of veterans. We support expanding this group to include disabled veterans and people with disabilities. Due to escalating housing costs, limited incomes, and a need for physical access, we find an ever-growing population of persons with disabilities being put on waiting lists for months, sometimes years at a time. In many communities, the local housing authority is the only option for someone with a disability, especially a physical disability where an individual might need an accessible unit. We support disabled veterans being put at the top of the list because, unlike many individuals who have been disabled for years or even their entire life and know the ropes, most of the disabled veterans coming back are entering a new world of disability, and many have an immediate need for access. In addition, this bill will help with the Options 2 initiative, which is to relocate individuals with disabilities under the age of 65 out of nursing homes into community settings. I have a letter of support from the Paralyzed Veterans of America, and I've received a message of support from the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs for support of House File 1684. Thank you for your support.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cox. Any other questions? Representative Shumper.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Medora. Given all our discussions yesterday at our committee meeting, I just think it's a terrible, sad commentary that we have to give preferences to one group over another group just to find some basic housing. I mean, it just really makes you angry, I guess. I don't know. Maybe we ought to pass an addition to the deed tax to fund some housing in this state.
Madam Chair, Representative Shumper,
let's talk about it.
Yes, members, but not at this time. Okay, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I apologize. I was doing a bill in another committee here, and while I appreciate the intent here to create an advantage for disabled veterans, I think one of the other things we need to think about as well is sometimes the disability is difficult to deal with, but sometimes the families that have to deal with those disabilities are, in a worse shape because they're going to have to change their entire life, particularly for those who have gone over, they've served, come back, and now they have a disabled member to try and adjust to. And I guess I would take exception to this, the wording that you got in this, in that I would prefer to see a disabled veterans, the families of service members who are disabled, and then persons with disabilities. Because I believe that they have paid a price, and that consideration for the price that they've paid is not just by them, but by their families in light of the separation that they usually entail in acquiring this disability, you know. So I guess I would prefer to see that in a little different lineup if we're going to do this at all, Madam Chair. And I would kind of submit that to the author.
Madam Dutter and Representative Severson, the only comment I have really is we're not competing against one another in this instance. Many times the disabled individuals competing for a different unit as opposed to the family of the deceased veteran, or they may need an inaccessible unit, whereas the disabled vet is going to be seeking and the community, disability community would be seeking the accessible unit.
Again, Madam Chair and Representative Severson, the issue here is all things being equal. If you do not need an accessible unit, then this is not. The issue is if it's an accessible unit, that the first preference be to we're targeting single dwellers for that part of the. That. So if we have a disabled veteran, that he or she is given preference for a one-bedroom accessible unit over someone who is not disabled. If that criteria doesn't exist, then a disabled person who's on the waiting list would give preference for an accessible apartment. And then families are normally looking for a two- or three-bedroom apartment. That's a totally different level of housing that they're looking for than what this is addressing. This is trying to give our disabled veterans and people with disabilities access to housing that is already accessible. So all things being equal, and it's an accessible unit, this is the priority we would like to have that
the renting authority to be looking at. That's the goal of this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. That is a helpful clarification. I'm just wondering if the language, maybe we could talk about this a little bit more as this goes into the bill. Maybe just even explain that a little bit, because it seems like it may, while it's clear, the intent is clear, it doesn't quite say that in the language. Maybe we could clarify that as we go along. Representative Farland.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, since this has implication for veterans, should it be going to the Veterans Committee? No?
Representative Madar.
We do have a letter of support from the Paralyzed Veterans of America, and also we've worked with the Disabled American Veterans representative on this, too.
Yeah. Representative McFarland, I appreciate your thought, but you know, we're at that time in the session. We may not want to, unless that committee chair asks for it. If they do that, we would certainly honor it and move it there. I think what we do today is put it within our omnibus bill. If they want to pull it out and have it come to the committee, we're willing to do it. At this point, my guess is that particular committee, I know that's part of the Ag Committee, right? They're probably not going to be asking for any more bills. I think they're having a hard time getting their bills heard. But we can, you can check with it. Representative McFarland, get back to us. That would be fine. Any further questions? Oh, another person. Sorry. Okay. Then, committee members? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would, maybe this is what you were referring to, Madam Chair, but I mean, there isn't any place in the bill that talks about this being a one-bedroom apartment. And, I mean, that was what I kind of, I picked up that was kind of where you were. In fact, in the bill, it actually refers to families of veterans as having a preference here. There could very easily be a two- or three-bedroom accessible apartment. And I think if that would be my understanding of where Representative Severson was going, that I mean, if there is an apartment that has more and there is a family of a veteran looking for that family, looking for an apartment, that would be the priority. So, I mean, I just a clarification. It's not clear in here. The explanation that you gave, I don't see that as being very clearly defined in the bill.
Representative Madar.
Madam Chair, I guess at this point I'm a little cautious to put in the criteria of what that housing would be, because for example, if it's a small cottage that somebody has made accessible as a rental unit on their property in rural Minnesota, I would hate to have the criteria be a one-bedroom apartment. The issue is that a single person looking for an apartment has a limited income opportunity to spend on housing, and that's what makes all things equal. If it's a single person, we're just asking that if it's an accessible unit, that the criteria for rental be this priority. First disabled vet, then people with disabilities.
Okay, Representative Eastman.
I mean, you're saying some stuff that's not in the bill. A single person, does that mean an unmarried person? Does that mean a person without a family? Does that mean an individual person? A disabled veteran may have a family.
Yes. And so
I think what I read the bill is originally before that you're changing here is that it was trying to address the fact that there are families of veterans that also have that we try to keep connected to this thing. So all I'm saying is that I think there's some unclarity here. So as we move forward, I think it would be good if that language was clarified and addressed, then maybe it could be something we could talk about in the future.
Okay, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess as I read this thing through, without the new language, there was an intent here that for family members of members who are killed in action, that they would, or in the military, that they would actually get preferential treatment in terms of affordable housing. And I buy off on that because they've gone through a drastic change. Their main provider is now gone, and they have to go through a transition. And to give them consideration for the services that they're service member has rendered, I think, bodes well for this. I have exception when we're bringing in disabled veterans. I don't necessarily think that's bad, but I think there's also, for the disabled veterans, there's a lot of other programs that we have through the VA and through the federal programs that get them where they need to be. So I'm kind of, number one, I'm reassessing this and saying, well, the disabled veteran has a lot of resources at their disposal, and then are we bringing in those with disabilities to compete with the same housing that we've originally given over to, given the advantage to those who are family members or service members who are killed while they're in the service. And I think it changes the entire intent of this particular paragraph. And if that's not the case, then I would hope that we would send this to Veteran Affairs so that we could clear this up, because I think this has Now, this has a little more implications than I had initially thought. And as Representative Eastland brought it up, and I got a chance to read through this whole thing, we're taking a piece of statute, and then we're creating another entitlement through that piece of statute, which it was originally not intended for. And so I guess, based on that, I would hope that we wouldn't put this in the omnibus bill unless we do some drastic changes, as Representative Eastland was talking about, and draw out what exactly we're trying to do here, because this is a very vague.
Representative Dorr.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Again, Representative Eastland, I appreciate where you're going with your questions here, but again, the issue is that we have got 3,600 veterans coming back. We have quite a few that are coming back with disabilities that went over to Iraq and to Afghanistan without disabilities. Mm-hmm. Coming back into this country, once they are discharged from the VA, depending on their tier, is where they are given preferential housing through the VA system. What we are trying to address is these veterans coming back that are being put into a brand new maze of disabilities management that they've never had to deal with before. They are now needing housing because perhaps they're not able to go back to where they lived before. If they have a wheelchair now and they didn't before they left, their families are not able to accommodate them. This gives them preferential treatment in accessible units. That's all this bill does. And it says all things being equal. That's the equalizer. If it is an accessible unit and it's available for rent and there is a disabled veteran on the list, that person be given first shot at having that apartment. If he has a family, then he is more than welcome to apply for a larger apartment. Perhaps that's what he's on the waiting list for. But the issue is these are accessible units, and our housing shortage for people with disabilities is so significant here in the state of Minnesota. The numbers would stagger us today if we sat down and looked at it by community. So what this does is it gives preferential treatment to people on waiting lists. If an accessible unit becomes open, the disabled veteran would have first shot at it, then a person with a disability, and then family members of people who were killed in action. Again, I doubt very much that families of people that were killed in action are going to be looking for an accessible handicap unit. So this is what this bill applies to, all things being equal.
Representative Shepard?
Madam Chair, I thought it was quite clear the first time I read this exactly what kind of preferences we're giving. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that Representative Severson, you're dwelling too hard on it. It's just at its face value, it seems to me. Everything being equal is the characterizing phrase. It's simply, as Representative Medora has repeatedly says, everything being equal. You know, the apartments aren't the same size and so on. Things aren't equal, and so, you know, it kind of sorts itself out. It just doesn't seem to be vague or unclear at all to me.
And Madam Chair, to that point, Representative Shepard, can you show me in this where it says that it's a handicapped rental unit?
Representative Shepard, I think maybe I can help with that, if you don't mind. Do you want to respond?
No, go ahead.
I think it's talking about the one that uses the word ineligible. I believe the eligibility there is referring to the type of apartment. So if you have an apartment that is handicapped accessible, then that plays into the eligibility. That's my understanding. Now, I know we're not all experts in the housing lingo here, and that's fine, but I think what might be helpful, Representative Medora, is to come back with maybe the rules that apply to this and how that works, and maybe we can get help from the council so that we can clarify what this means. I don't think anybody here is really disagreeing with what Representative Medora is trying to do. I do want to just make one comment, Representative Severson.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not mistaken. I don't think we're doing such a great job in getting our disabled veterans into housing. It seems to me like the number of homeless veterans, the number of people who are homeless who are veterans, is more than 20%. I can't remember exactly the number. So we have a lot of people who are not being helped by the system yet. And I think this is another tool in the toolbox. So I don't know, Representative Shepard, that's what I wanted to say. I don't know if you wanted to add to that.
That's what I wanted to
say.
Madam Chair, I'm more than happy to do that. But again, I will resist language in here that restricts a specific type of apartment, because in our rural communities we can't ascertain exactly the housing that would be available and accessible. So I'd like to be sure that greater Minnesotan veterans are able to get housing on this preferential treatment list here. So that's, I guess I would just like to lay that out. But I'm more than happy to go back and see if we can get more clarifying language as to how the process works.
I think that's what's being requested.
Yeah.
I think Representative Stevenson, we hear a willingness from the author to do that.
Yeah.
Representative Lane, I'm going to take one more question from you, Representative Stevenson, and then we're going to need to adjourn very
soon. Just a quick comment, if you're going to look back, I'd just like to know when this statute was originally designed, because it may relate to World War II.
Okay, there's another assignment for you to find out.
Thank you, Representative. Yes, I will.
And Madam Chair, to your point, I think in terms of, it kind of accentuates, we need to get the Department of Veteran Affairs in here. I know they may have sent a letter on this, but I know having worked with them, they send lots of stuff out without really having an opportunity to dig into this thing. And I think having the commissioner come in and address this specifically, and maybe that's where we can say, maybe we can even tailor this to, you know, to say what are the specific needs. I've heard those numbers, and, you know, I've been working in the area for a little while. We're doing, you know, progressive work to try and rectify that situation, and so I would hope that this is some stuff that would help in that process as well. But I'd like to get his feel on this as well. So,
Representative Madar, have you met? Have you talked with the people, or have you talked with the commissioner, any of the folks in his department about this?
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, yes, I did. I worked with the Disabled American Veterans Group, who actually handle veterans coming back applying for services through the VA. We, through this organization here, they work with the Paralyzed Veterans of America. I'm pretty clear on what their criteria is for housing and what they needed. And their goal, again, is to be able to provide housing that is accessible for disabled veterans coming back. That is their goal. They did not want to have a complicated piece of legislation that would lock them out of opportunities for rental. So this was to satisfy them and to give them preferential treatment coming back, because their job is to basically deal with the 20% that are coming back with significant disabilities. And we do not have the housing now in the state of Minnesota to deal with that. So if we can get these people on a waiting list and give them some preferential treatment, we might be able to get them into housing sooner.
Let me just offer this, Representative Stevenson. I'm satisfied that you've had those conversations. Mm-hmm. I encourage you to have a conversation.
And yeah, I will, Madam Chair.
If there's something we're missing, we'll come back and look at it. This is going to be in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, okay, if there's any further discussion, if not, then House File 1684 has been moved for inclusion, to be laid over for inclusion, possible inclusion in the omnibus bill in this committee. Not for the discussion. That will occur. Now, members, we have time to get over to the session. It's good today. And our next meeting is next Monday, and we're going to add another committee meeting, I believe, on Wednesday. Monday, 5:30. We're having a meeting at Monday at 5:30, so please put that on your schedule. It should be already sent out to your LAs, but we want to make sure that you know about it so we can get the rest of the bills that are waiting in line in this committee before us. And I compliment you all on getting the bills moved through today. Meeting is